Good evening. Hi, everybody. It's so wonderful to see all of you. Can you hear me? I just want to make sure my audio is working. Yes?
Good. Yes.
So I started by muting you, but it's okay if you're not muted. That's fine. I'll kind of go through the game plan here in just a minute. We're going to wait for people to sign on, and then we will get started.
It's working over here. What I did, I got your ice.
Champagne glasses.
You have to turn yours off.
Love it.
Okay.
She's starting now.
Okay, I've got a couple more people that I know are going to be here, so I'm going to wait just another minute, and then... And then we'll get started with our program, our toast, and our discussion.
And then just mute it.
I'm gonna be here in a moment.
Go ahead and mute Terry. There we go. Okay. All right. We're going to go ahead and get it started. It's 5 o'clock Pacific, and I know that some of you are on the East Coast where it is already 8 o'clock, and so I don't want to go too long. So I want to start a little, just telling you a little bit about Life Legal. I think most of you know who we are, but just in case you don't. Life Legal is a nonprofit pro-life law firm that defends vulnerable human life, especially children in the womb, from the threat of death. We have been protecting defenseless babies in the courtroom and the public square since 1989, so that's over 30 years. We handle a wide variety of cases, some of them in-house and many through our large network of affiliate attorneys, some of whom are on the call with us tonight. So we handle a large variety of cases. We represent pro-life advocates outside abortion clinics. That's how actually Life Legal got started. We protect pro-life speech in many different contexts. We have handled forced abortion cases involving minors, employment discrimination based on pro-life views, and many, many others. We are currently, for example, representing a gentleman in his capacity as a board member or former board member of the Center for Medical Progress in the Planned Parenthood video cases. We have written countless Supreme Court briefs in abortion and abortion-related cases, including several briefs in the Dobbs case, which we're going to be discussing tonight. And we also, on the other side of the life spectrum, intervene in cases involving the denial of life-sustaining care, and we're currently handling a number of high-profile cases like that, where an individual wants to withdraw life-sustaining care by, in the cases that we're handling right now, by removing a patient's food and water and effectively starving and dehydrating them to death. Joining me tonight is Katie Short. Katie is Life Legal's chief legal officer. She has been with Life Legal from the very beginning, and is one of the top legal experts, and I would actually argue that she is the top legal expert on abortion jurisprudence. And then tonight, as you know, we're going to toast to the end of Roe v. Wade. And when we do the toast, I will ask that you unmute yourselves so that we can all cheer together. And then following the toast, Katie and I will be discussing the Supreme Court's decision issued on Friday in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization. And then we'll discuss the implications of that case. Following our discussion, we will take some questions. I think we'll have about 15, maybe 20 minutes for questions. And you can at that time either raise your hand and I will call on you for a question, or you can type your question in the chat box. So I anticipate our total event lasting just about an hour. Before we toast, I would like to open with a prayer, and I'm going to read to you our Life Legal prayer, which our staff prays daily for our cases, for our clients, and also for our supporters. So if you could please join me. in praying, O Lord Jesus, who stood before judges and rulers and who sent apostles to do the same, grant that the Holy Spirit may inspire all our advocates with knowledge, wisdom, and zeal. Grant that we may rightly defend your followers as they stand for the threatened child in the womb and for the vulnerable, ill, and elderly. And as you are the Lord of history, grant that we may ultimately prevail against the culture of death in all its manifestations. We also ask that you bless and protect all our volunteers and benefactors engaged in this great effort, that we be good stewards of your resources, and that you give us wisdom to know our needs, the ability to obtain them, and the strength to persevere to the end. All this we ask through your merits, O merciful Savior, who with the Father and the Holy Spirit live and reign, one God, world without end. Amen.
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 Okay. And now I would ask that you unmute yourselves so we can toast and maybe even cheer to what I mean, I can't even hardly believe that we're doing this. I have to say, it still seems so unreal to me. And before we do that, sorry, I just want to thank Marissa and Andy Amador, owners of Majorum Vineyards, who are the makers of this fine wine. And they helped us create the special Life Legal label in their winery. So they have been so generous in their support of Life Legal and the protection of children in the womb. And we are just so very grateful. let's see, does everybody have their glass? You know, some of you chose me with wine, some of you can toast with water, sparkling water, whatever, that's fine. There we go, I love it, Colette. Perrier.
Hey, by the way, wait, I gotta say, so San Pellegrino, San obviously means it's a saint, yes. But he's the patron saint of cancer victims, and this is a beverage that my husband liked, and so I'm drinking it in his honor.
Oh, thank you for sharing that, Colette. Oh, wow. I did not know that, so that's... all right, so here we have our toast. Mostly the end of Roe v. Wade and Casey versus Planned Parenthood, and the court that made it so difficult not just to pass legislation restricting abortion, but also to make any meaningful abortion restrictions stick. Well, we hope and pray for protections for the unborn in every state and the ultimate end of abortion. We want to take this time to celebrate a decision many of us have been praying and working towards for decades. So here is to the end of Roe v. Wade and to the lives that have been and will be saved because states can finally prohibit abortion again.
Here, here. Yay! Yay!
Yay! I'm just taking a tiny sip because I have to talk about
speaking role. Yeah.
So I can keep you unmuted, but if you have a lot of background noise, you might want to mute yourself again. So I'm going to let you regulate that. And I'm going to start by giving you a brief overview of the Dobbs case, and then Katie can jump in at any time, either correcting me or adding some nuance and detail to what I'm going to say here. So the case the Supreme Court handed down its ruling on last Friday is Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization. I think most of you probably know that. And the case involved a Mississippi law that prohibited abortion after 15 weeks. Now, Jackson Women's Health Organization is the last remaining, or was the last remaining, abortion clinic in Mississippi. It's called the quote unquote pink house because of its bubblegum colored walls. And Life Legal has been working to shut it down for many, many years. We've been engaged with pro-life advocates there. We've engaged with the police there. We've gotten the police to back off of harassing the pro-lifers there. But the good news is that the clinic is going to shut down completely in about 10 days because Mississippi has what is called a trigger law that takes effect upon the court's overturning of Roe v. Wade. And that law makes it a criminal offense to perform an abortion in Mississippi. So Mississippi Attorney General Lynn Fitch recently certified the law, and it will go into effect on July 7th. So I just listened before this call to an interview with one of the abortionists or abortion staff from the Pink House, and they are going to be moving that house to New Mexico. So they will still be doing abortions, which is obviously tragic, but Mississippi will be completely abortion free as of July 7th. So now getting back to the Dobbs case, this decision is sometimes referred to as a 6-3 decision and sometimes as a 5-4 decision. So the 6-3 decision is the majority decision that the majority opinion plus Chief Justice John Roberts in overturning the Mississippi 15-week abortion ban. So the decision was written by Justice Samuel Alito and joined by Justices Kavanaugh, Barrett, Katie, you might want to help me out here.
Thomas.
Thomas, yes, of course. Okay. And I think that's it. So we're going to be talking about Justice Thomas a little bit later on as well.
Sorry, Gorsuch. Did you say Gorsuch?
Gorsuch, yes, Gorsuch, of course. Okay. And I think we have, so that's the 6-3. The 6-3 is to overturn the Mississippi statute.
No, uphold.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Katie.
No, I'm saying the 6-3 is to uphold the law.
I'm sorry, uphold, yes. Yeah. Yes, the 5-4, on the other hand, is to overturn Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey. So, and Chief Justice Roberts did not sign on to the majority opinion, unfortunately. And we're going to talk about why after we talk about the majority opinion. So, as I said, Justice Samuel Alito wrote the opinion for the majority. His opinion focused primarily on whether the 14th Amendment's reference to liberty includes a so-called right to abortion. Now, the 14th Amendment, as you probably all know, prohibits states from depriving any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, and also prohibits states from denying to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Now, the due process protects two categories of what are called substantive rights. The first is those rights guaranteed by the First Eight Amendment. So those are express constitutional rights. And the second category, which includes abortion or had included abortion, comprises a list of fundamental rights that are not mentioned anywhere in the Constitution. And so in making that determination, whether a right is protected, even though it is not actually mentioned in the Constitution, the court looks at whether the right is quote unquote deeply rooted in our history and tradition, and whether it is essential to our scheme, or to our nation's scheme of ordered liberty. So whether abortion was deeply rooted in our nation's history and tradition is what was asserted in Planned Parenthood v. Casey in 1992, just 19 years after Roe v. Wade, where the court affirmed its ruling in Roe in part because they said, just again, 19 years after Roe was deemed to be settled law. But Alito said, no, in fact, Roe and Casey are not settled law. And then he went through a history of abortion laws. So, and noting that at the time the 14th Amendment was drafted, every state had laws criminalizing abortion, and 3/4 of states had laws making abortion a crime at any stage of pregnancy, so completely prohibiting abortion. And then even when Roe was decided in 1973, over half the states had laws restricting or prohibiting abortion. So basically Alito said, this is just not part of our scheme of ordered liberty. This is not deeply rooted. We're talking about a case that has been highly controversial from the outset, and that comprises 50 years of our long legal history. So Alito also then went after the viability framework set forth in Roe that basically held that in the first trimester, you couldn't regulate abortion at all. And then unborn babies got more and more protection as they neared delivery or neared birth. So what he said specifically was that Roe's failure to justify this critical distinction between pre-viability and post-viability was a glaring deficiency in the case, and called that line of viability arbitrary. So Anne has and also said that that line, that viability line between pre-viability, when a baby allegedly cannot survive outside the womb, and viability, when the baby can survive outside the womb, that this is a ruling that has not found support among philosophers and ethicists. So, and I want to note here that Life Legal actually was, in our brief, we discussed this viability standard quite a bit because we had provided a brief, an extensive brief to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services on viability and on the problem of viability. And our brief in it to HHS was in the context of premature babies who in some hospitals were categorically denied care altogether. So some hospitals just don't provide care, even though a baby could be viable, but they will not provide care at all. Whereas other hospitals have very aggressive intervention. And those babies actually in those hospitals, very early preemie. So we're talking 21 to 24, 25 weeks, very, very early. Those babies have a survival rate of over 60%. So we address the viability standard and the arbitrariness of the viability standard at length in our amicus brief in Dobbs.
I just want to jump in here real quick for something. When we actually filed two briefs in the case, one at the petition stage, and when Mississippi was simply asking the court to take the case, and then the second one after the court had taken the case. And I just tooting LLDF's horn here a little bit. At the time, for the petition stage, just getting the court to take the case, we were one of only seven briefs that had been filed to support Mississippi at that point. After the court took the case, there were like 80 briefs supporting Mississippi. But as people know, I mean, I don't want to say half the battle, but a significant percentage of the battle is getting the court to take a case to begin with. And so I'm particularly proud that we were there at that stage to say, this is important, take this case. And then this turned out to be the case where Roe was overruled.
Yeah. And I really think at the time, when we submitted our last brief, I don't know. I mean, we did urge the court to not only uphold the Mississippi statute, but take this opportunity to look at the 14th Amendment right to life of unborn children. But yeah. I was not super optimistic that we would be where we are today. So maybe Katie, maybe you were.
Well, I saw at that point at the petition stage, trying to get the court to take the case. We didn't argue just, you know, take the case so you can uphold this 15-week ban. In fact, we specifically said we had a whole brief about viability and specifically said, and, you know, really, this doesn't have much to do with a 15-week ban because nobody at this point thinks a baby is viable at 15 weeks. But the point was to say, yes, take this case to overturn Roe because it was just a irrational, unworkable decision.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. So, and Alito actually did note, or the majority noted in their ruling that viability has changed over time and is heavily dependent on factors, including medical advances and the availability of medical care. And then we also argued in our brief that viability is also dependent on the bias of a particular hospital or a particular physician in terms of any potential disability that child may have or other things that have nothing to do with that person's or that baby's humanity as such. I thought it was interesting also that Alito named several constitutional scholars who are pro-abortion, but still criticized the court's reasoning in Roe. And you can read that in his brief, but among those are our Lawrence Tribe is the one that really sticks out to me. Because he's been pretty vocal about his opposition to the court's reasoning, yet still saying that abortion should be legal. And then Alito also talked about how the court basically short-circuited the democratic process by closing it to the large number of Americans who disagree with the court's decision in Roe. So, and then in addressing the dissent, which we'll talk about just very briefly in a few minutes, the Alito and the majority discussed the quote unquote reliance interest. So the dissent had said that the people are now that, first of all, that abortion is part of our settled history, that people are relying on the existence of abortion and the legality of abortion in any state in terms of making their decisions and their decisions about intimacy and things like that, which I just find really always really upsetting when I hear that, because it means that women, well, first of all, women are making bad choices because there's another bad choice that they think is going to rescue them from their bad choice to begin with. And Roe has, and Roe and Casey have contributed to that, not just the ease of making those bad choices, but compounding those bad choices with the decision to abort, which has lifelong consequences. So, and then Alito also talked about this issue of politicizing the decision, or this perception of politicizing the decision and the overturning of Roe for political reasons. And that is something that the dissent and many people, I'm sure that you've heard now, are very critical of this court of doing, taking a decision that they felt should have been, that the Mississippi statute, first of all, should have been struck down, and then that Roe v. Wade should never have been overturned because of this political opinion. And yet, ironically, they're using even more political and other kinds of pressure to try to influence the court's decision, or and they still are, and we're definitely doing that before the decision came out. And Alito said, absolutely not. We are not going to allow our decisions to be affected by the perceptions of other people in terms of whether this is political or not. But the reality is that because Roe v. Wade is overruled now, abortion is once again a political decision, a state-by-state political decision. Now, the focus of Alito's opinion was on whether abortion was a liberty protected by the 14th Amendment. He never, ever discussed whether the life of a child in the womb is a life protected under the same amendment. And I personally feel that that's really, really unfortunate, because we are now in a situation where children, unborn children, will have different rights depending on which states they are in. So they can be, you know, I mean, you can have a child that has no rights and that can be easily targeted for abortion, can be aborted through the ninth month of pregnancy. And then 100 feet away, you can have a child whose life is thankfully protected. And that, as Abraham Lincoln has said regarding slavery, that will not stand. This nation is going to be, and I believe this is true of abortion as well, cannot continue to be this house divided. It is going to be either one thing or another, all one thing or all the other. And it's been pretty much all the other for 50 years, and we will see now what happens. But I don't think we can remain as divided as we are on this. And regarding the 14th Amendment right to life, many constitutional scholars have argued that unborn children are protected by the 14th Amendment. And ironically, they cite the same laws and same history as Alito does in his opinion, but come to a different conclusion. Of particular interest, I thought, was a brief, an amicus brief that constitutional scholars Robert George and John Finnis filed in the Dobbs case. And their conclusion was that the court must overturn Roe and hold that the Mississippi law is not only constitutional, but is required because the unborn are persons guaranteed equal protection and due process by the 14th Amendment. And other scholars like Josh Craddock have written similar, have come to a similar conclusion, and they've written some papers that I would really encourage you to read. And if you're interested, you can let us know, and we can send those to you. So ultimately, the holding in Dobbs is that Roe and Casey must be overruled because the Constitution makes no reference to abortion. No such right is implicitly protected by any constitutional provision, including the 14th Amendment. So, Katie, I don't know if you want to add something at this point before we get into the concurring opinions and some of the implications.
Yeah, well, I'll hold off until we get to the concurrences. Those are actually, it's kind of I don't want to say more interesting, but it's I do want to add one thing about the main part of Alito's opinion, which is he addressed all the arguments that had been raised in support of there being a constitutional right to abortion. He you know, the ones that were raised initially under Roe, which was a very scattershot, maybe it's here, maybe it's there, maybe it's somewhere in the Constitution. And then when Casey came along, they sort of rooted it in, as Alex said, the liberty interest of the 14th Amendment, but almost as if anticipating something that I had been a little concerned about, which is that the pro-aborts would just, next time around, just they'd find a compliant federal judge and find some other constitutional provision, some other way to sort of ground it in the Constitution. And the obvious choice is the Equal Protection Clause, saying that that restricting abortion treats women unfairly. And so Alito actually heads that off. He addresses that argument head on and says it's raised in certain briefs, but you know, I'm just gonna tell you right now, no, the Equal Protection Clause doesn't do it for you either. So I appreciated that he was saying, you know, sort of getting out in front of that argument so that, you know, a federal judge would not have an excuse to say, well, maybe it's here. So anyway, that was the one point I wanted to make about his decision.
Good point, really good point. And I'm just gonna go really briefly through the concurring opinions. So Justice Kavanaugh did write a concurring opinion. So agreeing with the majority, but also saying that the Constitution is neutral on abortion because it never mentions abortion. I would disagree with him there for the reasons that we discussed regarding that the right to life was protected, the right to life of unborn children was protected at the time the 14th Amendment was drafted. And there are cases and other laws that indicate that that the drafters contemplated unborn children in their in terms of the whose right to life is protected under the 14th Amendment. And I also think it's problematic because, again, I think the analogy to slavery is really apt. It's not a perfect analogy, but I think it's very, very close in terms of what is a human person, what kind of rights to human persons, what kind of rights should we be protecting of human persons, things like that. And I think if you had said, okay, the Constitution is neutral on slavery, the Constitution technically wasn't neutral on slavery, so it's not, again, it's not a one-to-one. But I don't think, again, returning abortions to the states or certainly returning slavery to the states solves the problem. But that is Kavanaugh's position. And it's kind of, I have to say, I'm only saying that because of the decision that was handed down. The decision that we got in Dobbs is one that we had been hoping and praying for, like I said, for decades. And it seems a little unfair now to criticize it and say, well, we could have got something better.
Never satisfied.
It's true. And then regarding Justice Thomas, he also wrote a concurring opinion, basically, and this is the one that's gotten a lot of press, where he talks about the problems with substantive rights, rights that are not enumerated in the Constitution, and says we just need to do away with this whole idea of substantive rights and pretending that they are protected by the 14th Amendment altogether. And that's where he specifically cites the court's opinions in cases like Obergefell, where the court held there was a right to same-sex marriage and things like that. So I know he's been getting a lot of flack for that, and I'm not going to go into the nitty-gritty of due process, but I don't entirely disagree with him.
Well,
not. And then Chief Justice Roberts again wrote a an opinion concurring in part with the majority, so concurring in the upholding of the Mississippi 15-week abortion ban, but disagreeing with the court in terms of overruling Roe v. Wade altogether. He said the court went way too far. It should have just done exactly what it was asked to do, although at one point it was asked to overturn Roe v. Wade. And it wasn't just the pro-lifers who were saying you either need to affirm Roe v. Wade altogether or overrule it altogether. It was the attorneys for Jackson Women's Health who argued that as well. So, and that's not surprising that Roberts would come down like that, because he is a big proponent of stare decisis, of the court not issuing these really jarring rulings. And this is going to have a jarring effect. I think a very positive jarring effect, but nevertheless, it is going to and has upset quite a few people. I don't know if you saw last night, I was looking at some reactions, and I don't know how to describe these reactions with women screaming and things like that, other than this is just some kind of demonic manifestation. I mean, it's just really, really, I shouldn't even laugh, because this is really serious the way that some women are and men are responding. Katie, before we, and we're not going to, like I said, we're not going to talk about too much about the dissent, because we're kind of getting, I don't want to take away our time for Q&A, and then also for the implications. So I don't know if you want to add something here.
Actually just a couple of things. One about Kavanaugh's opinion concurrence, and I what somewhat bothered me about his concurrence, it started because I was actually out at a counter protest, you know, after the decision was leaked, the pro-aborts were joining, you know, going down to our city hall. So a few of us went down as well and had these conversations with some of them. And what struck me, I've been doing this for a long time, but it was for the first time I was really struck by the attitude of this is a zero sum game between women and their babies. One's going to be a winner, one's going to be a loser. Because these people is like, you want women to die, was their attitude towards us. And I was really saying, now I get why, you know, why can't we love them both? Why that's kind of a phrase that is used, is because these people really don't think that's possible. And so I was somewhat disturbed by Kavanaugh's concurrence, because he starts pretty much right out buying into that, saying we have this irreconcilable conflict between women and their children. So I thought that was too bad that he's of that mindset. I mean, ultimately he comes down on, you know, yeah, one's gonna be the winner, one's gonna be the loser. We'll let the states decide. But still, the fact that he sees it that way was a little bit disturbing.
Yeah.
As far as Thomas's opinion, well, just Roberts, touching on Roberts' concurrence briefly, you could see that coming down the road at the oral argument, where he kept on saying, well, we're just talking about a 15-week ban here. We're just talking about a 15-week ban here. He was clearly focused on that in a way that no one else really was. And as Alex said, it was the respondents and the Solicitor General, the U.S. Solicitor General, who kept saying, no, there are no half measures. There's no middle ground here. You have to, either strike down the statute or you strike down Roe versus Wade. And so with that opening, the majority says, okay, we're striking down Roe versus Wade, which is why I think it's interesting, and this is going to segue into the dissent, with Thomas's opinion, where he says, well, right now we don't have to talk about it because there's no case before us, but the logic, you know, this is only one of several of these decisions that were made relying on the idea that we can, there are certain unenumerated rights that we find in history and tradition and concepts of ordered liberty, all of which are very subjective and somewhat, sometimes sort of, you know, policy oriented decisions. And what I thought was interesting in the dissent was that they're basically saying, you know, bring it on. Bring it on. They're almost putting that same all or nothing choice again, just the same choice that they just lost on Roe versus Wade, you know, is an all or nothing. They're basically saying it's all or nothing about substantive due process as well. If you're going to strike down Roe, you're going to have to strike down these other cases. Do they really want to go to, you know, they're the ones who are putting that you know, binary choice before the court. And I do agree. I think that Thomas is right about that, which is either there are these, you know, vague right. I mean, some have more base, you know, you could still, like one of the examples that keeps coming up is about interracial marriage. The court striking down a ban on interracial marriage. And although that decision is considered to be somewhat of the first in a line of decisions having to do with marriage, it is also sustainable on a sort of equal protection ground itself. You don't have to say it's a right to marriage, but there's an equal protection element in that too. Something that really is what the 14th Amendment was about the treatment of the races. But I was just struck by that in the dissent, how having just lost that all or nothing gamble on Roe versus Wade, they seem to be ready to go at it again on all these other decisions.
Yeah. And my response to that is, okay. You think we should strike down Obergefell? Let's do it.
The thing is, they present it as a sort of reductio ad absurdum. You know, do you want to see these, you know, rights go away? And if they are absurd, then they won't happen because no legislature is going to do that. No legislature is going to try to legislate against interracial marriage. Yeah. You know, and you know, all to the extent that these things have become so deeply enshrined that they raise them as you can't possibly want that. Well, then it won't happen because the people's elected representatives would have to vote for that to happen for it to even become an issue before the court.
Yeah. Well, and they do, as you said, they try to throw in cases involving race as substantive due process cases. But again, these are really equal protection cases, classic mm-hmm. equal protection cases. And so you can't intermingle those. Those are two separate things. So, but if they're talking about, you know, the so-called right to same-sex marriage and things like that, those cases, yes, I'm all for let's overrule those. So, I want to talk a little bit about the dissent. Basically the dissent says that from the very moment of fertilization, a woman has no rights to speak of, which I think is the most unusual way of phrasing that, because what happened under Roe is that from the moment of fertilization, an unborn woman had no rights to speak of, had actually had no rights to speak of. So, and now they're saying that a woman, because she cannot now pay somebody to kill her unborn child, has no rights whatsoever to speak of. I mean, I just think that is so, so disturbing that, of course we know this because we've been doing this for a long time, but to really think again that there are people who fully believe with all of their being that the only right worth protecting and is the so-called right to abortion, and that everything else has to fall in line behind that so-called right. And so when you remove that linchpin, and it's the same with I've talked in some of my emails about Alexander Stevens, what he's called the cornerstone speech, where slavery is the cornerstone of of all of society, of the religious aspect of society, of the culture, all of it. And when you remove that, your society crumbles. That is how these people 100% feel about abortion. You take away that right in some states, and I say right, it's not a right. It was never a right, but you take away that in some states and they think their whole world is crumbling now, which is, again, so disturbing. And it's disturbing that trained lawyers would write something like this and not immediately understand how hypocritical that very statement is. Then they talk about that women will no longer now have the right to kill their children with disabilities. That's a big discussion that's going to come up. And of course, that child is a child, is a human being, no matter their disability. And I was just thinking about a really tragic case that we're involved in, involving a baby who was diagnosed in the womb with anencephaly. So part of its skull was not formed properly. And the doctor said, the baby will probably just live a few minutes after birth and then die. So the woman was pro-life, the mother is pro-life, and did not want to abort her baby. But the baby's condition turned out to be much better than the doctors originally anticipated. And so the baby lived and is still alive now, I think 3 weeks later. And now the mother, for humane reasons, wants to end that child's life. So, and this is just the other side of, again, the cases that we deal with, but often like this, they're intertwined, because the right to life is the right to life, whether you're talking about an unborn child, whether you're talking about somebody with a disability, even a profound disability. It's a right that needs to be protected. So, and I believe that the more the rights of unborn children are protected, particularly under the 14th Amendment, the more all of our rights are going to be protected, as in terms of our rights as human beings. And that's really about all I want to say, because obviously I disagree with the dissent's opinion that a woman's whole value is predicated on her ability to get an abortion on demand, and her whole ability to contribute to society is predicated on that right. I mean, these are just things that I think are really condescending towards women. Like, women cannot function unless we have this right to kill our children. It's just really horrendous. And sometimes I think they don't realize how what they say sounds. But Katie, I don't know, do you have anything else that you want to add about the dissent?
No, I think, again, it was just, I would say that invitation to take Thomas's, to make that binary choice. I thought, okay, you lost the last gamble. So,
yeah. So we'll see whether, how that might play out. So I want to talk very briefly about trigger laws. Trigger laws are laws that a number of states enacted prior to last Friday's ruling in anticipation that that Roe v. Wade would at some point be overruled. So 13 states in all have enacted laws that either upon the like at the moment of the ruling, or with certain criteria. Some have a 30-day waiting period, some have other certification requirements, but that abortion will be outlawed in those states. And by outlawed, I typically mean that there will be criminal liability, in some cases civil liability, but criminal liability for the abortionist. So again, 13 states in all have trigger laws. Mississippi, like I said, on July 7th will end abortion or criminalize abortion. Oklahoma has already done so. Missouri has already done so. And then there are 10 other states that are in the process of either certifying the laws or waiting for the 30-day period before they outlaw abortion as well, in which cases abortion clinics in those states will shut down and move to other states. And then, of course, in California, where we are, legislators are expanding abortion access radically to include and protect procedures that are done outside the womb. So to protect perinatal death as what they call a pregnancy outcome. And perinatal death is a death that occurs either late, usually late in pregnancy, or through up to the first month of a child's life. And the legislature has not specifically defined perinatal death, but it has also not said that it excludes deaths that occur from an abortion once a child is already born. And then California is also creating a right to, a constitutional right to abortion, but also a right to self-induced or do-it-yourself abortion. So we're keeping a very close eye on what's happening in California. We are, we launched an extensive campaign, a digital marketing campaign, to let people know that that California is planning to legalize abortion after birth, which is no longer abortion, that's infanticide, and some of the other things that they're trying to do. And then we're looking at how we're going to possibly challenge those things. There is a lot more that we could say about the decision, about the implications of the decision, what's going to be happening at the state level. But I want to be mindful of our time, and I want to open now an opportunity for any questions that you all may have. And Katie and I will do our best to answer them. And if we can't answer them tonight, I will be very honest and say, I don't know that, but I can find out for you. So, and then we'll get back to you. So you can either use the raise your hand feature, which I'm looking for, or you can just literally raise your hand, or you can ask a question in the chat box. So do you see where the chat box is? I just want to make sure everybody's clear on how to ask the question if you need to or want to. Father Genuine. I have to say, Father Genuine is a good friend of Life Legals. He has been at several of our staff retreats, ministering to our staff and encouraging our staff. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful blessing. And he is now a full-blown lawyer. So he went to law school and passed the bar and in Michigan, I believe, and is now a licensed attorney.
That's right. And was, in fact, just recently sworn in.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. Sworn in and bar card and certificate and everything. They're like, you know, you don't need this. If you really want it, click it. And I'm like, yes, click. Clicked everything. But all right. And this is a Michigan question, really. And then tying in some nonsense from one of those, what do they call themselves? The squad. Occasional Cortex has made this big to do about, we're going to impeach all the justices that took this liberty away from women. And I'm saying, okay, in Michigan, we have a 1931 law that criminalizes abortion as a felony, and fine. A judge in Michigan has said, no, no, no. And so a judge I'm not trying to point fingers, but let me just use adjectives, our lesbian Jewish attorney general has filed for an injunction. The governor has filed for an injunction, and Planned Parenthood has filed for an injunction. The injunction has been granted, freezing this outdated 1931 pro-life, or as they call it, anti-abortion law. Now, this is, you know, they're saying, oh, these justices are legislating from the bench. And I'm going, wait a second. That's what's happening in Michigan. The federal government, the legislating from the bench happened in 1972. It's been overturned. It's been reversed. And now in my own state, they're legislating from the bench to freeze a law that was passed in 1931. And So there's things like that where abortion should be illegal in the state of Michigan. And it's being held up by Planned Parenthood, the Attorney General, and the governor. And it's like this sort of thing is going to become insane, because you're going to have, you know, Democrats in power, and then in Michigan, most likely we will have Republicans in power, and this will flip flop until, you know, it's, and so this sort of thing is happening in states which are states basically where, you know, what are they, there's a term for it, but I can't think of it right now. I'll blame the line. But anyways, okay, am I making any sense?
Father, first of all, I just have to say, apparently you missed my insightful article in the last issue of Lifeline. So where I talked about, I had an article where we talked about the problem. There's two layers where our pro-life laws could get hung up. One was the federal courts with Roe versus Wade, but the other was state courts and state courts interpreting their own state constitutions to contain a right to abortion. And no state constitution has an explicit right to abortion. They're doing the same thing that the Supreme Court did with finding it, you know, sometimes some of them have at least a right to privacy. But it's, you know, what that exactly means is vague, but sometimes they find it in a due process clause or an equal protection clause or things like that. But they have, and so I have not, I'm aware of the Michigan litigation. I haven't actually, you know, read the decisions or anything like that, but I assume that what's happening is you have state court judges saying that this law violates the Michigan state constitution. And that is a real, I mean, it's not a big problem in California where you're not going to get where, yes, our Supreme Court said there is a right to abortion in the state constitution, but we're never going to get any pro-life legislation passed here anyway in the foreseeable future, or New York or Maryland or things like that. Where it is a problem is where you have the legislature is willing to pass restrictions and the state Supreme Court is standing in the way of that. Iowa just recently flipped on that, their Supreme Court. Their Supreme Court had 4 years ago said there was a right to abortion in the state constitution, and then the court just reversed itself and is says, no, there is no right to abortion there. So that's what's going on. With that, I mean, I think I see the problem. As I say, I anticipate you were going to get pushback even in the federal courts. Well, you will have judges who will just not accept this, and you might take two or three more trips to the Supreme Court to say, no, we really, really mean it. But we do have, that's the problem with the state Supreme Court's unelected judge. Well, sometimes they're elected, sometimes they're unelected, but also charting their own course on these things.
Yeah. And Michigan has no right in the Constitution. In fact, what's even more awkward is in Michigan's Constitution, and this is another decision that was that main decision on schools, Michigan actually has an amendment that prohibits state funds being used in religious schools. It's not just a law, it's in our Constitution. And so that one is kind of, it's like, well, not, you know, how are we going to, and I'm very interested in both of those decisions, because in both of those decisions, we've in Dobbs, we've got a law. In fact, one of our state reps has just said, okay, if 1931 is not good enough for you, we'll just resubmit the 1931 law and vote on it and see where we go. So there's a 2021 bill that is exactly the 1931 law. But on the other hand, our state constitution actually prohibits the use of money in religious schools, which is the main decision, which came out Thursday or Wednesday.
Well, I don't know exactly what your state constitution says, but the state constitution cannot, a provision there cannot stand if it violates the federal constitution. So if there is a conflict, what the court just said about what is required by the First Amendment will control. Here's a little fun fact, though, about state constitutions conflicting. Mississippi itself And this is really surprising to people because it's a obviously a very conservative state. But it, I guess at some point in its history, it had a pretty liberal Supreme Court. And so there is actually a Mississippi Supreme Court decision which says that abortion is protected under their state constitution. So I don't know. I mean, so technically, theoretically, Jackson Women's Health Organization could have gone back and started the whole thing all over again in state court. But they didn't, probably because they could see the writing on the wall that 30 years later, you know, that probably the Mississippi Supreme Court would come out differently on the issue.
Yeah. I'm going to go to some of the questions in the chat. So the next question is, can states make it illegal for their citizens to get abortions in other states?
That is a subject of heated discussion right now, law review articles and things like that coming out. A lot is going to depend on how it's done, what exactly that means. Do you mean to travel to another state to get an abortion? Probably not. To bring in pills to the state, you know, have the abortion, the means of abortion come in from another state. That is more a more plausible way of doing it. And I know there are a number of states, I think, are actually working on that, because I think we see that the future of abortion is chemical abortions, you know, for going to be for most abortions. So, and that's going to be a very important area to explore, is how far can states go in restricting the importation of pills, whether they're mailed or delivered or whatever. And so it's something definitely we're keeping an eye on.
Yeah, good. All right, and what is the status of the leaker, and will he be punished to prevent recurrence?
Sure wish I knew. I don't know that. I haven't heard.
I was waiting.
I don't have any inside knowledge about that one.
I don't
anybody
know.
Anybody else? I don't know.
I don't think there's a lot of political will right now to do anything about that.
Yeah.
So we'll see. That's a good question that needs a little bit of explanation. So what can states do to control the availability of Plan B, the abortion pill, through the mail? So I don't know, Katie, if you want to talk about the difference between Plan B and chemical abortion pills, or if you just want to address chemical abortion pills.
Right? Yeah, well, that's probably the next. Yeah, Plan B is something that is, you know, also called the morning after pill. It's something that works at a very early stage, and it has, my understanding, is different methods of action. So it's sometimes abortifacient, but not always abortifacient. And I have to say, I think that they're going to have to figure out how to get a handle on shipping mifepristone, which is indisputably an abortifacient and works up to, you know, it's certain, you know, there's, it's currently used up to 10 or 11 weeks. And I wouldn't be surprised if there will be a lot of trafficking in that, either from out of the country or, you know, from states which, you know, because, well, it, right now it's happening from other countries, and that's going to be very hard to stamp out. But, you know, at least we know what we're looking for. So, I mean, we know where the problem is in that case. So,
and as Katie said before, this is where all of this is going. All of this is going towards what is going to be done to regulate abortion, or what they call medication abortion, but usually medication doesn't always kill a person. Okay. What is your position on the personhood amendment? So I don't know if you want to address that. You want me? I know there are several different versions of amendments out there, so I think it's kind of hard to answer.
I'll give you my position on it. I mean, to just sort of speaking generically of personhood amendments I have known, and that is, I don't understand, if you're going to go through the effort to if you're going to go through the effort to pass an amendment, whether at the state level or the federal level, I don't know why you wouldn't just come out and say what you mean, instead of saying the unborn children, a child is a person. Well, I mean, you know, for instance, I always think, you know, if people think in terms of the 14th Amendment, well, we're sort of making it clear that the unborn child is protected in the 14th Amendment. I always think, but it was the 13th Amendment that actually outlawed slavery. So if that's what you want to do, why don't you just have the 13th Amendment equivalent for abortion and make it really clear so there's no guesswork about what exactly it means when you have unborn children being protected, you know, as persons under the 14th Amendment. That's my take on that. I would just go at it more directly if I was going to go to the, if we're going to go through the trouble of having an amendment. I mean, go through all the work of getting an amendment passed, make it unambiguous.
Yeah. And I'll just mention what John Finnis and Robbie George said in their brief, which was that the right to life under the 14th Amendment would entail something like whatever a state's laws are regarding actions against or killing of unborn children or feticide, those would apply to all children across the board and all perpetrators across the board, so that the children would be protected. You wouldn't have an equal protection problem. In other words, the children would be protected, unborn children would be protected as any other unborn children are. So if a state had feticide laws that criminalized the killing of an unborn child by somebody else, those laws would apply against everyone, the abortionist, the mother, anybody that tried to harm or kill that child. So it would really depend on what the state's laws are regarding protection of unborn children in other contexts. And we have several board members here. So one of our board members, Dave Schenefeld, is asking, can local municipalities in pro-abortion states pass abortion-free zones like some do regarding marijuana businesses where marijuana is legal? So can they carve out an abortion-free zone in a pro-abortion state?
I think you could in a pro-abortion state that didn't have that, where abortion hadn't been held to be enshrined in the state constitution, because you're going to have a problem if, like California, you know, if you tried to do that in California, that law itself is going to be held probably to conflict with the state constitution as read by the Supreme Court. In other states, I don't think there would be any obstacle to that if you could. I don't know if, you know, and then the legislature, if you have a really pro-abort legislature, they might step in to try to, you know, preempt the area or something like that. But usually zoning is pretty much left to the local authorities.
Maybe that's something we need to look at. Sanctuary cities in California before they enshrine it. Okay, should we be concerned about the fear of packing the court? That's a good question.
I don't lose sleep over it at this point. I don't think. I think we're so close to the. I have great hope for the midterm elections. I just don't think they could get anything passed at this point that would do that. But I mean, maybe others. That's a political question. It's not something that. That I'm particularly concerned about. I tell you what. You know what I'm more concerned about? It did occur to me. You know, when we're feeling so good about this, I thought, gosh, if something were to happen to one of the justices and we felt like we had lost that majority, would the pro-aborts come right back and you'd have, I don't see a Sotomayor, Kagan, or Breyer, well, Breyer wouldn't be there, Jackson, it would be batting an eye at flipping it back. Yeah. But then the question is, would Roberts then stick to his stare decisis principles and say, no, this is the way it is now. I'm going with the last word. And the last word from the court was that, you know, there is no right to abortion in the Constitution.
Yeah, we'll see. That is all of the questions that are in the chat. We are just a little bit over our 1 hour mark. So I want to be mindful, like I said, of everyone's time, because I know that for some people it's very late. I do want to thank though, however, Terry Thompson, who's a Life Legal board member, Colette Wilson, who's also a board member, and Dave Schenefeld for participating tonight. And for all of you for joining with us to celebrate the end of Roe v. Wade. And hopefully we can do something like this and really discuss what is going to happen next in terms of chemical abortion and where that's going in the States. So thank you all so much. I wish you a wonderful evening and hope to see you again soon.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.